Good afternoon. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Celia Menchel, chair of the club's member-led Middle East Forum. To find out more about the Commonwealth Club, please go online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce today's speakers, distinguished speakers. Janine Zakaria is a journalist and news analyst who is presently a visiting scholar at Stanford University. She was chief diplomatic correspondent for Bloomberg News and has appeared on MSNBC, CNN, and Washington Week in Review, etc. From 2009 to 2011, Janine was bureau chief for the Washington Post in Jerusalem. Joel Brinkley is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and presently professor of journalism at Stanford University. He's the author of five books, including his latest compelling book, Cambodia's Curse. His columns on international issues appear in various media, including the San Francisco Chronicle. And Joel was bureau chief for the New York Times in Jerusalem. Please welcome Janine Zakaria and Joel Brinkley, journalists in the Middle East.
Thank you all. We're delighted to be here talking about what is, in fact, an extremely timely issue. Middle East seems always to be timely, but even more so now with all the foment in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Yemen, and now at college campuses in the United States. The way we're going to work is that Janine and I are going to have a conversation with each other, talk about relevant topics for about half an hour back and forth between us, and then we will turn the program over to questions from you, which you will submit and Celia will read to us. And we won't know what we're being asked until it's asked, so there's no prep time and we'll have to make it up as we go along. Janine, why don't you talk a little bit about what you think is where you think we're going after the events of the last few days.
Yes, thanks, Joel. And I wanted to extend a special thank you to American Jewish Committee for initiating this event, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting us. Certainly is a timely time, right, to be talking about these events. And I imagine you all have a lot of questions about what has happened in Egypt and Libya and throughout the Middle East. We see the violence expanding to many, if not most, of our embassies in the region, not only in the Middle East, but in the wider Islamic Muslim world. I have a friend in the embassy in Islamabad who is also, you know, witnessing protests there as well. So we're just going to touch on it, and then maybe if you have follow-up questions in the Q&A, we'll circle back to this, because Joel and I want to cover a lot about reporting in the region as well. I think there's a couple things that that the United States is really confronting here. The most important in the long term is going to be now the U.S. relationship with Egypt. And starting with the Arab Spring, and obviously the way President Obama struggled in the beginning to figure out whether to support Hosni Mubarak and whether not and when to abandon him, this is an issue that I think was left unsettled. And I think a lot of the American watchers, you know, as soon as Anderson Cooper and others pulled out, they thought the Arab Spring was over. But in fact, it was just the beginning of this period of tumult. And this video or 9/11 or whatever set off this wave, right, is just a flicker in what we're going to see going on and going forward. The United States has not resolved how it's going to deal with the fact that our most important ally, and I use the word ally even though President Obama struggled with that yesterday, whether to call Egypt an ally, and we can talk more about that, they have not figured out how to deal with the fact that the president of Egypt is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And this has become a very paramount issue, even though we're only 8 weeks from the election. This is something the United States is going to have to start figuring out. It's going to start at the UN in a week or two when the president is set to meet with President Morsi. Obviously, the fact that President Morsi struggled to denounce the protesters and it took a call from President Obama realizes how difficult the situation we are in. And so the whole situation with Egypt needs to be sorted out. And that's probably the most important thing. More broadly, a lot of people are talking about this film, right? And when it came out of California. But the true challenge for the United States right now is how they're going to deal with, and this is an appropriate conversation to have here in San Francisco of all places, how the United States, in its public diplomacy campaign to win hearts and minds in the Middle East, is going to be able to deal with social media and phenomena like this film, because there's going to be other films, there's going to be other things like this. And I think this is something that the State Department is going to be wrestling with, because public diplomacy, as I've been saying, is a long game, right? And the internet is immediate. And this is two things that we haven't really figured out how to reconcile. And lastly, and this is just perhaps a basic point, but I think that the day after story, once we get through the crisis that we're in, okay, is how are we going to secure our embassies? And both Joel and I have traveled around the world together, in fact, with the state, as part of the State Department press corps, and we've been to these Fortress America embassies, okay? We know what it's like in Cairo and these other places. And I was frankly stunned at what happened in Benghazi and poor Ambassador Stevens and the fact, a Bay Area native, and the fact that they were under assault. I mean, it was just how many months ago that we had NATO aircraft everywhere that could have taken care of this problem in an instant, and suddenly they were abandoned. I want to know more about why that consulate was so poorly protected, and there's going to have to be a reevaluation of the way the U.S. secures its diplomatic missions abroad, and I wouldn't be surprised to find that angle become one of the foreign policy angles, if any, remain for the rest of the campaign season. Joel, what are your thoughts about all of this?
Well, I want to talk about the political side of this, but after a quick observation that I think all of you are aware of. When the Arab Spring arose, the people demonstrating in all these countries wanted these things in this order: dignity, prosperity, and some additional freedoms. Now here we are a year and a half after the first one, and all the arguments are about Islam. You don't see any effort. Have you heard any of these Middle East leaders talking about what they're going to do for economic development? Not one. I'm going to write this sometime soon. But in any case, that's sort of the disappointment I see as an observer of this. But politically, I think Mitt Romney made a huge tactical error the other day. At a time like this, when a U.S. ambassador is killed, it's time for the nation's leaders to pull together and unite as one in despair and resolve. And that is what every Republican and Democratic leader in Washington did, except Mitt Romney, who chose to use it as an opportunity to try to lampoon President Obama. And I think it backfired on him. And I think this is going to be a factor in the campaign from this point forward, his lack of skill in dealing with foreign affairs issues. This is the first breaking foreign affairs issue that has sprung into the campaign. And this was a case where we could see how each side handled it, and Romney flubbed it. That's my opinion. Now, Janine, you were there in the Middle East during the first uprisings in Egypt, both in Israel and Egypt. What did you learn from that? What do you think?
Well, I want to take you back. I mean, it's an interesting moment to reflect. You know, Joel's talking about the origins of the Arab Spring. I was in Jerusalem for the Washington Post in January 2011, and they said, go cover the protests in Egypt. Now, it's hard to remember at the time, but nobody, including myself, anticipated that we would have a revolution that would oust Hosni Mubarak, and I got in a lot of trouble with my foreign editor for not anticipating that, because I didn't bring a sat phone, I didn't bring any of the things that you need to report when the president of the country decides to cut off all communication. So anyway, that's another story. But I wasn't prepared, but I wasn't prepared also because I had been reading the Israeli press, right? And in January 2011. There was a lot of assuredness among top Israeli security officials, I think a lot of this people don't remember, that Hosni Mubarak is going to hold on to power, no problem, don't worry. I remember people testifying before the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, he's fine. We talked to Omar Suleiman, the head of Egyptian intelligence, he told us everything's fine. So, of course, then I went to Cairo, and then we saw that everything wasn't fine, and sure enough, there. 3 weeks later, Hosni Mubarak is ousted. Now, at the time of those protests in Tahrir Square, there was very little mention of Israel. In fact, there remains very little mention of Israel, right? I mean, originally it was democracy-driven, but in a way, it's kind of predictable that that now the Muslim population, the radical Muslim population there, the radical Salafi forces that you keep hearing about, have now turned their anger against the United States, right? First it was against Hosni Mubarak, and now the leadership of the United States that always backed him. So I think this is the consequence that we're going to see. Nevertheless, when it comes to Israel and the way they perceive the region, it's a quite difficult time. And I've been kind of stunned over the last couple of months about how little this is being discussed. Everything's about Iran, and we're going to talk about Iran. But if you just look at this region right now from Israel's perspective, and I know Joel has a lot to add on this as well, they see Egypt led by the Muslim Brotherhood, as Prime Minister Netanyahu actually predicted at the time would happen. They had been building a fence along the Egypt, this is the Egypt-Israel border I'm drawing here, okay, in my imaginary map. They were building a fence to keep out African illegal immigrants. Now that is a whole new security, that's a whole new constellation now. They need that because they're afraid of the insecurity of that border. You see what's happening in the Sinai, lawless, there's the potential for, I mean, maybe I'm going on a limb here, but there is the potential for an Israeli attempt to reoccupy at least the northern part of the Sinai if that situation gets worse. Syria, we haven't talked about Syria this much this week, but 20,000, Joel? How many people have been killed in Syria? More than 20,000 people have been killed in Syria in the past year. You barely see anything about this in the press right now, right? But mostly journalists can't get in there after, I mean, poor Anthony Shadid, a friend of mine, and I imagine Joel knew him as well. Syria, I mean, when I was there in early 2011 talking to very top Israeli officials, and I talked to them about Syria, and I said, would you rather Bashar al-Assad stay or go? What do you think their answer was? They wanted him to stay at that time. Now they're not saying that anymore, but because at least the devil you know is worse than the devil you don't, you know. Lebanon, just as quickly, could be turned against. Hezbollah could be turned against. Jordan is very weak. You don't hear about Jordan. So the whole situation right now is very difficult for Israel, and they're going to need, in sum, more U.S. support. They're going to need more money. They're going to need more defenses, traditional defenses, at a time when there is enormous tension between Israel and the United States, and then we're going to get to that. Now, Joel, you were there last summer, I believe, right, when the Arab Spring was still erupting, and you spent a lot of time with Palestinians, right. Prime Minister Fayyad. Why don't you talk a little bit about how this affects the Palestinians, maybe?
Well, I was there a year ago when the first West Bank uprising occurred, the first one against the Palestinian government, not against Israel. And I asked Salam Fayyad, the Palestinian Prime Minister, about this, and he told me, there are calls for demonstrations every day, but these are demonstrations against our government. The minute the Arab Spring began developing, we began getting demands from the people. And then he said, and we welcome that. And I found that quite encouraging. Well, they're back on the street right now, right this minute, protesting against the Palestinian government because the government can't pay the full salaries for government workers. The price of bread and milk is twice what it used to be. And part of it is that they have not, the Palestinian government lives off foreign aid, and both the United States and Arab countries have not met the goals, the pledges that they've made. And for the United States, I don't know the explanation yet. I'll find out. But Arab states, as you know, have been using the Palestinian cause to preoccupy their people for decades so that they don't pay attention to the oppression of these dictatorships. And yet, when it comes actually to do something for the Palestinians, they're always absent. Always absent. And here they are not fulfilling their pledges, and the Palestinians are up against their own government. Now, then and now, the Israeli government often misinterprets what's actually going on in the West Bank. I find what's going on kind of encouraging, that the Palestinian people are making demands of their own government. I asked Nior Gilon, a deputy director general in the foreign ministry, about this, and he said there's a feeling in the air, fumes waiting to be ignited, violence may break out. He and others predicted a third intifada within weeks or months. That was a year ago, and nothing of that sort has happened. Now, it may be because the wall is up and they can't get to Israel, but I don't think that's it. Khalil Shakaki, a respected Palestinian pollster, told me, for the first time, nonviolence is becoming an acceptable strategy here. It's because of Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, and Yemen. People realize there's a lot more to lose from violence, And Fayyad was quite clear. I don't want to see us slide back into violence, reach a flashpoint where kids are killed. So I'm not saying there will never be another intifada. I don't know. It depends on Palestinian behavior, Israel behavior, and other circumstances. But for now and for the last year, Palestinians have been standing up against their own government and not blaming Israel for everything that happens to them. And I find that quite encouraging. So why don't you tell, there are also protests going on in Israel right now.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Well, I was looking, I mean, it's obviously not, I mean, you remember it was a year ago that you had the, I guess, what they call it, the 500,000 man march, or the, mm-hmm. I mean, you had protests in Israel at the same time as the Arab Spring protests, and they were protesting largely the prices. It was an inflationary protest, right? I mean, they were, and the main thing, I think, was the price of cottage cheese, which anybody who's been to Israel knows is a staple in the breakfast diet there. But it really affects people, and the price of real estate in Tel Aviv. And I don't want to say it was a yuppie protest, because there were a lot of people who were lower and middle class also, and it definitely pointed to the poverty levels in Israel, which exacerbate tensions, class tensions there, between the oligarchs that they have and the lower class. But, I mean, there are some protests now, Joel's right, but I don't think it's of the magnitude of last year. They were unable to sustain those social protests. But what's interesting to me is, you know, having looked at Israel over time, it sort of syncs with what Joel's saying, that when there's no crisis with the Palestinians, right, Israelis can look at their inner their problems among themselves. And they can look at their economic problems like they did last year. The news cycle moves so quickly in Israel, we forget what the big story was 3 months ago. But does anybody remember? It was about ultra-Orthodox and whether they should be drafted, right? It came to a head August 1st. There was a Supreme Court deadline to actually start enlisting them, right? But again, this is also the kind of issue that polarizes, to quote John Edwards, you know, in a way, misquote him, the two Israels. What did he say? You have the Kingdom of Tel Aviv, where you had these protests and where you still have some of these protests, and then you have sort of the other part of Israel, which, you know, and it's split along left, right, economically, who serves in the military, who doesn't serve, and all these cleavages really come to the fore. And I think if you continue to see relatively muted Palestinian protests, you're going to continue to see these kinds of tensions get exacerbated. You know, when you talk about, a lot of people always talk about U.S. aid to Israel, pretty much all the economic assistance is gone. I mean, and you know, rightfully so. Israel's a first world country now, economic. I think GDP is per capita is about 17,000 or something like that. They're way in the top tier. They don't need economic aid, but yet you have this kind of poverty that's just putting pressures on Prime Minister Netanyahu politically. One last thing, just an addendum to what Joel was saying on the Palestinians. I think one of the reasons, perhaps, that you don't also see this kind of protest is Fayyad and the Palestinian and President Abbas. This is something I reported on while I was there. There's a strict control of the mosques right now in the West Bank, and they to the point where they are vetting the sermons of imams prior to Friday prayers. And I think that in a way they are really working hard to contain potentially the kind of protests that we see erupting around the region all over. So we'll come back to that. But I think we need to talk about the other big story this week, right? Iran,
right?
The U.S. and Israel. We'll come back to the Palestinians in a minute. But Joel, I mean, what's your sense of this? I mean, everybody talking about now the red line that the United States refuses to set, the rebuff of Prime Minister Netanyahu wanting to see President Obama. Where do you see this going and potential for a strike?
Well, first of all, I think Bibi Netanyahu wants to see Romney elected and is doing everything he can to make sure that happens. That he thrust himself directly into the presidential campaign just a few days ago. You know about that, asking for this red line and saying that without that, the United States has no right to restrain Israel from attacking Iran. Well, I don't know what effect that's going to have, and I'm not going to predict elections, but in any case, I think it would be a huge mistake for Israel to attack Iran on its own. Last year I stood on the Lebanese border with an Israeli military official, and he pointed to missile emplacements, Hezbollah missile emplacements just over the border, Hezbollah, by U.S. and Israeli estimates, have 65,000 missiles in southern Lebanon pointed at Israel. 65,000. Last year, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, just before he left, said that Hezbollah has, quote, tens of thousands of rockets and missiles, more than most governments in the world, all supplied by Syria and Iran. Well, if Israel attacked Iran, you know Hezbollah would fire every single one of them, 65,000 missiles. Neither Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system or its formidable air force could deal effectively with any but a few of them. In any case, Israeli prime ministers are always happier when there's a Republican in office. That's a fact. That's particularly true now with, I think we can justly say, a right-wing prime minister in Jerusalem. And his relationship with Obama is at best tense, and Obama clearly doesn't like him, and vice versa. Martin Indyk, who twice served as ambassador to Israel, told me a couple of weeks ago, among some Obama administration officials, there's a sense that Israel just isn't acting in its own best interests, and I think a lot of people would agree with that. But he added, Israel can still do more or less what it wants because they know they have Congress in their back pocket. And that is absolutely true. Why is that? It's not so much a concern for congressmen about the Jewish vote. Remember, fewer than 2% of Americans are Jewish. It's wealthy Jewish donors, but far more important is hundreds of thousands of evangelical Christians who follow the cause in Israel and sound, if you talk to them, as I have, like Israeli settlers, that right wing about Israel issues. And they're all over the Midwest, and they are extremely important in a huge number of states, the states that are in play right now. So Bibi Netanyahu can come to Washington and have a tense meeting with President Obama, as he did last year, and then go to Congress and say hawkish things that have nothing to do with making peace and get standing ovations after every sentence in Congress. So is it any wonder that Netanyahu would rather see Romney in office? I don't think it's any at all. What is your view about whether Israel will in fact attack Iran if the United States does not?
Well, I think that the reason that Prime Minister Netanyahu went and is demanding this red line, meaning at what point will the United States consider it dangerous enough, or rather Iran's nuclear program advanced enough that it would in fact strike itself, is what he's saying, translated, right? It's precisely because Israel knows it really shouldn't or can't or doesn't want to strike on its own. Why else would he need a U.S. red line, right? I mean, he needs the U.S. to do this, I believe. And when you have Amos Yadlin, the former director of military intelligence in Israel, in today's Haaretz, today, you know, the New York Times of Israel, saying Iran's nuclear program is a 2014, maybe 2015 issue. We're not there yet, okay? And you have other top Israeli security officials also saying, no need to panic, no rush. I do not see Prime Minister Netanyahu launching a preemptive strike on his own, certainly not before the election, even if Drudge reports this or whoever, and maybe not by the end of the year, and maybe sometime next year. It happens every 6 months, this comes up now. And I think the reason you saw this flare up this week was a few things. First, it was prompted by Secretary Clinton was asked about this, and she said, we're not setting any red lines. And this made people apoplectic in Jerusalem, including Prime Minister Netanyahu. He didn't like that she came out and publicly said this. Secondly, I don't know, I mean, no one's really mentioned this, this is my suspicion, but Bill Keller of the New York Times, Joel, as you probably saw, wrote this long piece in Sunday's Times saying he'd rather take his chances with a nuclear Iran than see a preemptive strike. This would have made them crazy in Jerusalem, okay, to see that kind of placement of that kind of piece, because what it's saying is the U.S., conventional wisdom that we can't let Iran go nuclear may be eroding, okay? Then this happened. And so I think, and a couple other things have happened that suggested that Prime Minister Netanyahu was getting impatient with Obama, with President Obama. When he came in March to Washington, the whole discussion was about the red lines, and he didn't get any agreement with President Obama on the red lines. However, I think that in a way it is backfiring on Prime Minister Netanyahu to, in such a explosive way, pick a fight with President Obama or insult him, say you don't have the moral right to tell us what to do. It's like two kids in the sandbox right now, the way this is playing out. They have to take this behind closed doors and work it out. And the opportunity to do that is no longer with us because President Obama is not going to meet with him in New York. Now, there may be a change, maybe for political reasons, maybe there'll be just too much pressure on President Obama to be seen meeting Egyptian President Morsi and not Prime Minister Netanyahu in New York. I don't know. But at any rate, I don't think that they're going to see a strike. And one last thing on this. When I was talking to senior Israeli officials before I left Jerusalem in late spring 2011, it was very clear to me that the thing that Prime Minister Netanyahu values most about his accomplishments or his is the fact that he believes that he built a world consensus around this notion that we can't let Iran go nuclear. And without that, it's just his whole being right now. He doesn't care about the peace process. He doesn't care about other issues. And so it's vital to him that this remain on the world stage, I would say. And so, no, I don't think there's going to be a strike, Joel.
I agree with you.
Anytime soon.
Well, another really important moment you covered while you were there, and that was the flotilla incident. Tell us what you think the fallout from that has been.
Yeah, we're talking as journalists here, so I think it's important to talk a little bit about media and the way it plays. You know, as having covered this, Joel and I both, we often hear from readers and people about the foreign press and all that, and we're often demonized. But I think it's relevant to think about this. I mean, when remember the flotilla? You guys remember the flotilla, right?
Yeah.
So early, May 2010. And this ship's coming. There's all these people. Janine, go to Gaza and wait for the ship. So I went to Gaza and I was waiting for the ship, even though it was clear that Israel was not going to let that ship come at the time. And in a way, I remember in the days before that, it was almost like Israel was on a war footing, like the Navy was readying for this, as if they were about to be invaded or something. And so things were very tense. And I was awakened that morning by our stringer, the person who helps us, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, all have Palestinian reporters who help them in Gaza, telling me that 20 people had been killed on the ship. This was at like 6 a.m. And I said, what? You know? And we immediately had to start dealing with this crisis. And in the end, it was 9 people aboard the ship who were killed. But I find that that moment, that was a moment when I think we can look at when Israel really found itself. I mean, it's been isolated for a while now, but the isolation really grew at that point. And I think in a way did itself a disservice when it didn't allow the press to have access to people on the boat to actually report that story fully. We were very limited in what we were able to do then and as that whole thing transpired. And there's been lots of examples of this, I think, over time about, you know, how do you balance that? How does Israel balance, you know, its need to protect its interests and allow access to the press? You see this everywhere you go. And I think that moment, though, when Israel felt so alone, okay, and is continuing to animate Israeli foreign policy, okay, and where you have a lot of commentary right now where even the only country that we can rely on, the United States, is turning against us. So I think when you look at what's happening and the way Israel speaks, try and keep that in mind. Like, that's the way they perceive the world. They perceive the world a little different than the way we perceive them. So, Joel, you had some similar experiences, like covering on the ground there?
Well, I'm going to talk about the flotilla moment, which I wrote about at the time, and it showed rank hypocrisy of a sort you can never get used to, even though I've seen it all over. The very day that Israeli soldiers boarded that ship, and in what they said was self-defense, killed some people, in Lahore, Pakistan, the very same day, Taliban gunmen stormed into a hospital and shot and killed 12 badly wounded patients lying in their beds. The very same day. These were victims or survivors of a murderous attack on 2 mosques a couple of days earlier in which 93 worshipers were killed. So on that day, 105 people shot and killed in a hospital and two mosques. Did that warrant even an acknowledgement from the rest of the world? No. Navi Pillay, who was the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the United Nations, said nothing about the dead Pakistanis. Not one word, but managed to declaim, "I unequivocally condemn what appears to be disproportionate use of force resulting in the killing and wounding of so many people attempting to bring much-needed aid to the people of Gaza." This debate is surreal, but typical. The debate the week before the flotilla debate, North Korea sank a ship, the Cheonan, a South Korean ship, and killed 43 sailors, and the UN Security Council was going to have a debate about what they should do and to condemn North Korea. Well, then the flotilla incident occurred. The Security Council abandoned the North Korea initiative, and council members made it clear that they wanted to take up a resolution condemning Israel instead. This is the way it goes.
It's worth noting, I mean, this disproportionate coverage that you get of anything that happens in Israel and in the Middle East, I think, in general. But, you know, one of these issues that gets that kind of disproportionate coverage is the peace process. We haven't heard that phrase in a while, right? Peace process. And, Joel, why is that? What's happening there, you think?
Well, you know what? When I left Israel after my first assignment there, this was 21 years ago, 4 years. I gave a lot of speeches around the country, and people would always ask me, when do you think there will be peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis? This was right after the first Gulf War, just as the Oslo Peace Accords were being discussed. And I said then, when I was a much younger man, not in my lifetime. And I stick with that today. Both sides hold blame. Both sides hold a lot of blame, no question about it. But right now, if you look at these two peoples, the Israelis and the Palestinians, they look at each other across a deep chasm. They don't talk to each other, and they look at each other, each of them holding in their heart their deep historical grievances, interests, biases, and anger. And I don't see, they're growing farther apart. Israel, of course, has many enemies around the world, including Iran, as we've discussed about, that is working on nuclear weapons. But in some ways, both the Palestinians and the Israelis are their own worst enemies. On the Israel side, does any nation in the world endorse or support the notion that Israel can house 350,000 people in occupied territories? Not one nation in the world acknowledges that as Israel's right. And then we had this summer the Levy report from a former Supreme Court justice coming out saying that Israel, it's not occupied territory, it is their territory and they can do with it what they want, essentially. Fortunately, Bibi Netanyahu is smart enough not to have endorsed that report, but that gave Israel a black eye. And the Palestinians, more particularly those in Gaza now, repeated violence gives them a black eye. So I think both sides are working against a peace agreement, and as I said, I stick with what I said 21 years ago. How do you think Israelis see the so-called peace process, which I think now is a phrase is an oxymoron, but in any case?
I left my last assignment feeling that the Israeli Jewish population, at least, is very post-peace process. Like, that issue was very 90s or pre. The kind of protests that you saw last summer about the cottage cheese and the real estate that we were talking about, those used to be in the 90s. That was the kind of protests you had on the peace, issue. And you don't have that anymore. And the country's moved on. They want their high-tech and startup, and they want to sort of move past it, even without resolution of this. And I think we could talk more about this. We had a couple more topics, but I'm wondering if we should shift. What do you think, in terms of the time? about 20 minutes left.
Should we move to questions, or do we have some time?
5 minutes.
Okay. So we were going to talk about Hamas a little bit.
You want to do Hamas? Let's do Hamas, yeah.
And then we'll turn to questions. Both of us have interviewed Hamas leaders many times. And I'm going to go first because my experience is older, and then we're going to learn from Janine how politically they might have changed a little bit, although not philosophically. Yesterday, the Hamas publicly condemned the anti-Muslim film. They didn't say anything about the violence, of course. They did burn a couple of U.S. flags down there in Gaza. Well, as I said, I happen to have interviewed Hamas leaders a few times over the years, and my most interesting interaction came in 2002, a week after what had been a bombing that was called the Passover bombing. Does anybody remember that? Killed 25 people at a Seder in Tel Aviv. I was there and I covered that. So a week later, I went to see the Hamas people who took credit for it, and Ismail Abu Shanab, one of the organization's leaders, was sitting high in his chair with his chin raised. "Our spirit is high and our mood is good," he told me. "That was a great success. We don't have an army, but we showed that one person can do more than an army, that showed that if we suffer, our enemy suffers." That's what he told me. Well, Abu Shanab is dead now. Israel killed him the next year. But Mahmoud al-Zahar is still alive. In fact, I think he's the Hamas foreign minister right now. So I spoke to him, and he noted that by his estimation, the organization's recent attacks then in 2002, the one during the Passover Seder and another one at a Haifa cafe, had killed 15 people, were the most successful they had ever had. He was quite pleased. 40 were killed and 200 were injured in just two operations, he said with a smile. Like the others, Zahar lived in a large, comfortable home in the Gaza city. He had a big family, and Zahar had a ping pong table in his living room for his 7 kids to play. All of these Hamas leaders, and I spoke to 6 of them on this reporting trip down in Gaza for a week, they all offered their opinions in calm, careful tones as if what they were saying was completely unremarkable. Hamas, I was told, wants Israel to withdraw from all of the West Bank and Gaza, if they hadn't withdrawn from Gaza yet, dismantle all Israeli settlements, and grant full right of return to every Palestinian in the world. The Jews who remain, quote, Zahar said, in an Islamic state with an Islamic law. From my ideological point of view, it is not allowed to recognize that Israel controls 1 square meter of historic Palestine. What's interesting is that since then, in surveys and polls, a number of them around the Arab world, most Palestinians, the vast majority, 90% or more, say they have no interest in returning. None whatsoever. They've got lives and family where they live, and they don't want to go back. Nonetheless, Shanab insisted that he was not joking when he said there are a lot of open areas in the United States that could absorb all the Jews.
I'm just going to give a quick addendum to that. 10 years later, almost, not 8 or 9 years later, here's Hamas, okay? When you go to Gaza now, as a reporter, you go in, you leave Israel and you go in and you're admitted to Gaza by the Hamas security. You get a special ID thing they give you, and they, they created sort of like a border there. And Hamas leaders wear ties and suits, and they have a foreign ministry of sorts set up in Gaza, and they welcome you and they welcome delegations, anybody that will come from the Netherlands or wherever. And I had an interesting conversation with one of these leaders when I was there, I guess about a year and a half ago. And we were chit-chatting about things, and he said, "Janine, let me ask you a question." I said, "Yeah." He said, "What do Americans think of us?" And I said, "What do they think of you?" I said, "Well, if they know who you are, okay," which is probably a small percentage of Americans who actually know what Hamas is. We're looking at, not this audience, obviously, but they may remember that you blew up a pizzeria, Sbarro Pizzeria in Jerusalem, and killed a lot of kids. They might remember that kind of incident. And he said, "Really? That was so 10 years ago." And to me, it was a very striking comment, because they were trying to distance themselves from the kind of thing, when Joel and I were talking about it, it reaffirmed this for me, that they were trying, at least for the media, they were talking in a very different way. And they were and he went on to ask me, well, how could we change our image in America? And that's when I joked, you know, my rate's $200 an hour. You know, I'm not going to be your political consultant here. I'm here to do an interview about smuggling tunnels, you know. So, but to me it was striking, and what I realized after subsequent trips to Gaza and so forth is that there, like in Egypt, okay, Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, there are radical Islamists more radical than they are, that they are contending with. And I think this is something the West, and I know Israel understands, but the West, I think, has to see that when we look at the threats that we have today also, that it's more complex. It's not one group. A lot of what's going on in Egypt or Libya is actually one Islamist group against another, perhaps more radical Islamist group. And I think that's something that we're going to be processing in the years to come. So,
thank you. Celia gave me one comment that my partisan remarks about presidential election compromise my credibility. Well, I would like to point out I don't work for the New York Times any longer. I write a syndicated column, opinion column, so I'm entitled to offer opinions at this point in my life. Thank you.
Thanks to Joel Brinkley and Janine Zakaria. We'd like to remind our audiences on radio and internet that this is a Commonwealth Club program. Two journalists in the Middle East, Janine Zakaria in conversation with Joel Brinkley. We have many questions, so let's begin the question and answer period. There were several questions about Syria. What do you believe is the ultimate end game in Syria, and does U.S. and world inaction hurt us in the Middle East?
Joel, you want to start?
I think it does hurt us. We have almost the entire Middle East turned against Syria. Syria's only friends now are Iraq and Iran. Iraq that we spent about $2 trillion trying to turn into a democracy. Even Mohamed Morsi, the Egyptian president, has turned against Syria. I would personally, just as an individual, I would not favor sending American or Western or NATO troops there. But I think as France has advocated, no-fly zone or cruise missiles or something to try to defang the Syrian military probably is a good idea. As an opinion columnist, that's my view.
Just one quick thought. You know, I was talking to somebody in Lebanon who's very plugged in Syria, and you know, basically he said that the Syrians have calculated that if they kill only 20 or so people a day, then nothing's going to happen to them. That's the calculus in Damascus. If there's some big, you know, God forbid, they like attack a school and 200 kids, you know, they know they're going to try and avoid those kind of things. And given the fact that the U.S. and NATO ousted Muammar Gaddafi, and now our U.S. ambassador has been killed, and it's chaos, and there's that leadership's not ready to take over. Egypt is, who knows what's going to happen. Iraq, let's not forget Iraq, right? I mean, still not stable. And the prospect now of some kind of, maybe I'm wrong on Iran, you know, I just don't see any appetite for U.S. intervention at all in Syria, and I think it is going to be problematic longer term for the United States.
Do you consider as a serious option advocacy for a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, especially given the Israeli nuclear arsenal?
Do I think that there should be a weapons-free zone, or that there will be ever? Israel's never giving up its nuclear weapons. It will not. I mean, this is something that Egypt always harps on. You know, we are for weapons of mass destruction-free zone. I mean, I'm not going to say never, right? If for some reason down the road and, you know, Israel could have relations once again with Iran like it once had and, you know, somehow is more at ease, maybe there can be some sort of negotiated nuclear umbrella provided by other nuclear weapon states like the U.S.? I don't know, but I don't see that as a viable option at the moment. Joel?
I don't either. Mm-hmm. I don't believe Israel will ever give them up, and I think it, in some ways it's an excuse that other states used, such as Iran, for creating their own programs.
Okay. And what do you think of the possibility of Gaza seceding from Palestine?
It has, essentially. I mean, de facto, it's a different state there, everybody. It's totally different. There's no way to get between them, and between, I mean, Gaza and the West Bank. It has its own leadership. Hamas leaders are liking this. They're liking having their own little fiefdom there. They're getting rich off, you know, through the smuggling and all these things that are happening. They get to call the shots there. I mean, it's perilous for the longer-term two-state solution, because how can Israel negotiate a peace only with the West Bank? Now, there are some who say, let's just do it. Some in Israel, I mean. People like Shaul Mofaz and others who I think are, it would prefer, just let's do what we can now, realpolitik, right? But any effort at this rapprochement, which Egypt was mediating, I don't see it succeeding in the near term. There's too much vitriol between now. Once President Abbas dies and goes aside, maybe that calculus would change. I don't see a reconciliation in the immediate term. Joel?
I don't either. You may recall that a year ago, some of these demonstrations in the West Bank were not just economic issues, but demonstrations trying to convince the Palestinian government to make up with Hamas. And so this initiative, Egypt ran, came to sort of a partial agreement. But as Janine said, it's fallen apart. The two sides have completely different goals, and I think there's no chance that the two will agree under the current circumstances. Now, it's a volatile region and things can always change, but right now I see no way that the West Bank and Gaza governments will come together. And as Janine said, I'm not sure that the Gazans really want that. They've got their own little fiefdom, and they're, by their own estimation, they're doing pretty well.
Just quickly, there's one possibility. If they actually ever did hold elections in the West Bank, which I don't believe they've held since 2000, I don't remember.
Many years.
It's way past time. And if Hamas won, then maybe. I mean, that's a possibility.
And what do you think the future holds for the Copts in Egypt?
Oh. I've been researching this. This is a very sad thing. Did you know that Salafist Islamists, one of the extremist groups in Israel, is Egypt. Sorry. Thank goodness they're not in Israel. Is literally killing Copts at a furious rate. They are taking young Copt girls, 12 or 13, and selling them at slave marts as sex slaves. It is a terrible thing. And Mohamed Morsi is not doing anything about it. I do not see anything but bloodshed and terror in the future for Copts in Egypt right now. And I really find it appalling that the government does nothing about it.
It's similar, just quickly, one line. You know, when I was in Iraq, Iraqi Christians begging me to help them get out. What could I do? You know, please help me get out of here. It's dangerous for me. Remember, they were torching churches. I was there. They were setting churches on fire in Baghdad. I think Christians across the Middle East are in these kinds of conflict zones are in a very precarious situation.
Since the French Revolution, with rare exceptions such as Ataturk, all revolutions have produced a regime as repressive or more oppressive than that they replaced. Can anything be done about this?
Well, I haven't gone through every revolution that has occurred since the French Revolution in my head, but I do know that that is at least often true. I think Americans were naive to think that the Arab Spring would produce democracies. There is a principle that comes into play. The reason that Germany and Japan became democracies after we occupied them, we the United States and primarily, is that they were on their knees. There were no leaders or oligarchs left to vie for power. There was no leadership left, and the people were hungry for a new life. Every place where we've tried to implant a democracy, I think Iraq and Afghanistan are perfect examples. The leaders and oligarchs are still there, still vying for power. They want to hold on to what they have. And you cannot create a democracy in any country that doesn't have it unless everyone there, including the former leaders and oligarchs, are in favor of it. And that's been true for a long time.
You know, this has got to be one of the issues that comes up in the campaign. If they're going to talk about foreign policy, right? The future of U.S. relations and U.S. involvement in the Middle East and how we're going to deal post-revolutions, which we didn't start, actually, right? What is your vision, President Obama? What is your vision, Governor Romney, for this, right? I mean, I remember very clearly when President Bush delivered his speech at the National Endowment for Democracy in 2004 and said, what was it, 60 years of the U.S. supporting Arab dictators will no longer be a policy of the United States. He said, we're going for democracy, okay? Now this is playing out in a way. At least the ouster of the autocrats who were all of our former allies, right? And it's complicated, and there needs to be a vision that the United States comes up with for how they're going to navigate this very murky territory, I believe.
I'll tell you a quick story. In 2006, I was covering the State Department, and you were too, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to, maybe you were there, I've forgotten. We went to Morocco, where they were holding, the United States and the Moroccan government were holding a freedom forum and inviting foreign ministers from the Arab world to come and talk about democracy, part of the Bush initiative. So Colin Powell was Secretary of State at that point. And the press was in an adjacent room and looking through window at all these Arab leaders. They left the mics on for a few minutes for the opening statements, and then they forgot to turn them off.
It's our favorite when that happens.
Yes. And as soon as the people in the room thought the press was gone, all of the Arab leaders started screaming at Colin Powell about Israel. Nothing else, just Israel. And their undenying support of Israel. Democracy, the word never left a mouth.
Mm-hmm. What does President Obama mean when he says he has Israel's back? Speaking of Israel.
He means he wants to be reelected. I don't know what he might do after the election. Obviously, he's not going to do anything in the next couple of months. Whether he will attack Iran, I don't know. There's a debate between Israel and the United States about whether Iran is working to immediately create a bomb or trying to gather the materials that they can hold and put together in short order if the time comes they need a bomb. And that debate is unresolved and probably unresolvable. If Iran tests a bomb, I think the United States will act, and probably, I think we'll know before that happens. But we have Israel's back. When he started running for re-election, all criticism of Bibi Netanyahu went away, and we hear this rhetoric.
Do you want me to add to that? Look, the United States does have Israel's back. Okay, let's be frank, all right? I mean, there's a lot of things that happen every day that aren't in the press. Only these little flare-ups, the negative stuff, but Iron Dome, you know, and all these big projects to build anti-missiles and protect Israel from rockets coming in from Gaza. I mean, all these things are happening. The military cooperation is happening. And it means that if Israel was really in a moment where of peril, the United States would intervene and back it, is what it means. But this is something that there really is very little daylight between Democrats and Republicans. I mean, maybe you disagree, Joel, but I think that when you get, there's a lot of rhetoric about, you know, always being there for Israel and all that for the campaign. But in fact, I don't believe truly that actually President Obama and Governor Romney are that far apart on Israel. I really don't. And in fact, when people say, you know, detractors of President Obama on this issue believe that President Obama's been anti-Israel. Well, in fact, he hasn't demanded anything of Israel. I mean, beyond that 10-month settlement freeze in the beginning, which the Israelis agreed, what has he demanded of Israel? Someone please tell me. Because he really hasn't put pressure on them on the Palestinian issue. Not that I've seen. They had that spat about the 67 borders But no real, the kind of pressure we saw, say, under George Bush Sr. or something like that, right? So I don't really see, you know, much difference between them. I think that Governor Romney's trying to score some political points here.
Absolutely true. And one more thought. Mm-hmm. If I criticize the Obama administration, does that make me anti-American? No. And I don't understand why, if you criticize the government in Israel, that makes you anti-Israel. It doesn't.
How is being a journalist in the Middle East different from other parts of the world? And when you travel as part of State Department Press Corps, how do you avoid being viewed as a spokesperson for the U.S. government by local populations?
What a good question.
Well, I'd like to point out that Condoleezza Rice, who is now at Stanford University, will not speak to me because she hated what I wrote about her when I was covering her.
I personally love being a reporter in the Middle East. I love it. My parents and my husband didn't always love it, but I love it. It is, especially for me, I fell in love with the place, and going around and you have great access in the Middle East. And in Israel, you know, we can argue about, a lot of the internal discussions in the Jewish community, is Israel still a democracy, is it not, post-Zionism, blah, blah, blah. But I can call any Knesset member on his cell phone and interview him, you know. I remember when I was based in Jerusalem, and then I was moving to Washington for the Jerusalem Post. This is now back in late 1999, and a spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Israel said, you know, you're not going to be able to call these congressmen on their cell phones when you get there. Turns out you can sometimes, but it's an enormously open society where you can really move around. Me with my name, also just as a very personal observation, is Janine Zakaria, okay? And a lot of people didn't know, is she Arab, is she Jew, and is this? And they would always ask me, where are you from? That would always be the first, what's the kind of question you get in the Middle East, right? Where are you from? You know, and they want to know, you know, I say, oh, I'm from New York. And they would say, no, where are you from? You know, and so they want to really be able to, because they want to size you up and determine what's your religion, are you a Likudnik, are you a Laborite, are you this, are you that? And actually among the Palestinians, they were very especially open. But even when I went to, you know, Saudi Arabia, you're able to talk to people. And now in the State Department Press Corps, I think that's such an interesting question, because I think when you get to some of these repressive places, they're not used to a free press corps. They don't know. They see us all traveling around on the bus and typing. They think we're just typing what we're told to type. But one time I was traveling with Bill Fallon, who was this is separate from the State Department. He was the head of Pacific Command and later Central Command, and we were in China. And he was going into the meeting with his counterpart in China, and I was prepared to wait outside, of course. And he said, no, come in with me. I said, what do you want me to do? I was the only journalist on the trip. It was like a special thing. He said, because they don't really get it. They're going to have their press there, and then they're going to want to see that I have my press there, and so just come in with me. You know, and so it really, he just sort of recognized that they have no idea, so just you might as well be in the meeting anyway. This circles back a little bit to what we've been saying about free press, freedom of speech, all of these things is something we need to explain in the Middle East to the world, and I think that's going to be something you're going to hear Hillary Clinton and others explaining a lot in the coming weeks.
Unfortunately, we have time for just one more question, and I'm combining two. That would have been a lovely question to end on, but this is my favorite question.
All right, save the best for last.
Okay, what can we individually do to make a difference toward bringing all of the world's people together as one family? Second part, I know. How do people relatively inexperienced with free speech, open societies, etc., learn to respond to criticisms and conflict without always resorting to violence?
Wow.
Yes, and
all we are saying.
Yes.
Well, I think everyone has a role as journalists. We write about repression and other indignities that are visited upon societies, and if you have a prominent platform, I think that plays a role. But the world has always had oppressive societies, and I think it always will, and I don't see that any of us as individuals or groups can change that in any dramatic way. But we all try, and I think it's important that we do.
I think that's a good way to end.
Okay. Thank you. Our thanks to Janine Zakaria, visiting scholar at Stanford University, and Joel Brinkley, professor of journalism at Stanford. Thanks to our audiences here on radio and the internet. I'm Celia Menschel, chair of the club's member-led Middle East Forum, and now this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 109 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.